From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
I'm just a modern chick who does what she wants.
In the new film comedy Trainwreck, Amy Schumer plays a young woman who doesn't want to be in a committed relationship.
A lot of this version of myself is based on me in college, where I did have a bunch of partners. And
songwriting
so,
partners?
Yes, songwriting partners, John.
Today, we talk with Schumer about writing and starring in the film, and with Judd Apatow about directing it. Also, journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about his new book. It's a response to the violence many young African Americans face on the streets and from police. Coates grew up in West Baltimore, where he had to learn to stand up for himself.
You know, one of the first things I learned in middle school is that any sort of physically, violent threat made to you has to be responded to with force.
And Ken Tucker reviews Jason Isbell's new album. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with Amy Schumer, who wrote and stars in the new movie comedy Trainwreck, and Judd Apatow, who directed and produced the film. Schumer has become a feminist comedy icon for her hilarious take on body image, sex, gender, relationships, and pop culture. On Thursday, Schumer was nominated for an Emmy for Best Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for her performance in her Comedy Central series, Inside Amy Schumer. The show itself received a total of 7 Emmy nominations. Judd Apatow directed and wrote or co-wrote the films The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, Funny People, and This Is 40. In Trainwreck, Schumer plays a single woman named Amy who doesn't want to commit to a relationship, unlike her sister, who's married and has a child with another on the way. Amy is a writer at a men's magazine, where she's assigned to write a profile of a sports medicine doctor, in spite of the fact that she's not interested in and knows nothing about sports. She hits it off with a doctor, who's played by Saturday Night Live veteran Bill Hader. They start seeing each other, but that doesn't change her reluctance to commit. That reluctance is partially explained by a flashback scene at the beginning of the film, when she's a young child and her parents are divorcing. Her father, played by Colin Quinn, is trying to explain to Amy and her sister why he can't be faithful to their mother. The children are carrying their dolls.
I don't know what your mother told you, but let me explain it from my side in terms you can understand. You got your doll, right? You got your doll there.
Yeah.
You love your doll. Yes, but what if I told you that was the only doll you were allowed to play with the rest of your life? How would you feel?
Sad.
You'd feel sad. Of course. There's other dolls you like, and they're making new dolls every year. You want a stewardess doll?
Yeah.
What about a slightly overweight cocktail waitress doll?
Yeah.
What about a doll who happens to be best friends with your main doll?
Yeah.
It could happen, right?
Yeah.
What about a doll you only play with one day and never see again?
Yeah.
So that's why me and Mom are getting divorced.
Amy Schumer and Judd Apatow, welcome to Fresh Air. I love that explanation about why monogamy isn't realistic. So this scene helps explain why your character is afraid of intimacy, because she's been brought up with this idea that monogamy isn't realistic. So did you come of age thinking that too? That, like, relationships don't last? So why bother?
My parents were both married 3 times, and they got divorced when I was, like, I think, like 12 years old. So, and just seeing the way they kind of behaved, and then my own observations from, like, the normal little teenage heartbreaks, and I think also the stories I liked. It was like all Les Mis. It was all these unrequited love stories. I was just pretty sure that I was just gonna have my heart torn out. So I've always had this like major fear of having my heart very broken because of unrequited love. And that's actually never happened, or not so far, but I live in constant fear of that. And I think that was reflected sort of in my behavior and not wanting to get too close to anyone. Yeah, I have mostly been in long-term relationships, but I think I've never really given myself over to them for the fear of being hurt.
Judd Apatow, you suggested that Amy Schumer write a screenplay after hearing her on Howard Stern and hearing her be so funny on his show. What did you suggest? Like, when you approached her, what did you pitch to her?
Well, actually, first I called Ronnie the limo driver. And he refused to write a script. And then I asked...
You gotta stay on him about that.
I asked Gary. I asked everybody. Well, she was telling stories about her relationships and also stories about her dad who has multiple sclerosis and what it's like to have that relationship with someone who's going through a chronic illness. And the stories were very dark and sad, but also showed a lot of love for her dad. And they were really funny and warm at the same time. And I remember sitting in the car thinking, this is a hilarious stand-up comedian. And I don't think she understands what a great storyteller she is. So I thought I would tell her.
So, Amy, once Judd Apatow asked you to write a screenplay, you did write one, and it's basically your version, your take on a rom-com. It's part parody of that and part that. So I'm interested in hearing some of the things that annoy you about rom-coms and some of the things you really like about it that you wanted to work with.
I would say what the things that I think annoy everybody about rom-coms, you're just like, we just know all the points that the story has to hit. Like, okay, there's going to be a conflict and then they're going to be okay. And, you know, it's just like kind of, it feels like a little exhausting. So I think, like, I think the format, there's a reason that that's the format. You don't want it to be like, there's no problem. And you just kind of watch these people fall in love and then they die. there's got to be something. But, you know, sometimes when it's just any time it's not earned and like, or when they don't actually have chemistry and you're just like, come on.
Let's hear another scene from the film. And your character, Amy, has a rule in the movie, don't stay overnight with a man, unless it's like your boyfriend and you're already in a long relationship. But sometimes she drinks so much she wakes up in a man's bedroom and has no idea where she is. So in this scene, she's just violated her rule, and she stayed overnight with Aaron, the sports medicine doctor, played by Bill Hader, who she's just started to see. And the next morning at the office, she describes the night to her friend and colleague Nikki, played by Vanessa Bayer. And in the middle of this scene, we're going to hear Aaron, the sports medicine doctor, played by Bill Hader. We're going to hear him call her. And his best friend, LeBron James, is sitting next to him, trying to listen in on the conversation. So Amy speaks first.
I slept at the doctor's place last night.
Oh my God, because you were like blackout drunk?
No, that's the thing. I was dead sober.
I had like two drinks.
Three max. Four now that I'm tallying, but it was like,
okay,
I was sober.
So you barely drink?
Barely.
Because you're on antibiotics or something?
Oh my God, he's calling.
Why would he call? You guys just had sex.
It's probably a mistake. It's a mistake.
He's butt dialing you.
Hello?
Oh, hey there, it's Aaron.
Oh. This is Amy. I think you butt-dialed me.
No, I dialed you with my fingers.
What'd she say?
Shh.
He called me on purpose.
Hang up. He's obviously, like, sick or something.
Yeah, what's up?
I was calling to say I had a really good time last night. I was wondering if you wanted to, hang out again.
Will you say that again, please?
I was wondering if I could see you again.
You know what? I'm gonna call the police.
I love that a man wanting to see you again is like a sign of psychotic behavior.
Yeah, like this is obviously a pyramid scheme.
And Amy, you're great at getting what's funny, awkward, and sometimes just bad about new sexual experiences. And the funny things about sleeping together with someone for the first time, like your character hates to spoon and says, I think this is so great. She says, let's try to sleep in a realistic position. Did you sit down and just try to think, what are the most embarrassing or awkward or just like physically uncomfortable things about spending the night with someone for the first time?
Yeah, well, a lot of this version of myself is based on me in college. I would say my sophomore year specifically, where I did have a bunch of partners and, you know, who I knew I wasn't going to date. And
songwriting partners?
Yes, songwriting partners, Judd. And we try to keep Judd very sheltered. We told him that his daughters are here because of storks bringing them. So there were these experiences. And yeah, like, you know, sometimes you'd be like, okay, I'm going to spend the night here. And then there's some guy and he's like breathing on you and you're just like, oh, like, and you just, yeah, you just resent him. So I was like, what if this were different if I were to actually just say to him, like, I'm not going to try to just be the thing that you want and try to be this perfect person for you. I'm like, if I'm going to stay here, like, I'm going to put a pillow between us and don't breathe on me. Just that she's communicating with someone for the first time. Like, I'm going to just say what I actually want instead of trying to be some fantasy for you. But for me personally, yeah, there's this like misconception like that women want to be held all night, and some do, and I'm sure, and some guys like that, but I love spooning. I love, you know, I'm like a like latchkey dog. Like I love to be, I guess they all are, but I love to be held, and I'm very affectionate. But when I go to sleep, I'm a like, please don't come anywhere near me person.
I mean, your character's father has MS, and during the movie moves into assisted living. And one of the things your character and her sister has to do is kind of pack up his stuff and decide what to keep and what to save. And even though the father has MS, it's not like he's just treated as this, you know, person who is now weak and vulnerable and everybody's just totally sympathetic to, because he's a really... he's the kind of guy who speaks his mind whether he's right or wrong, and he tells you what he thinks you should be doing, whether he's right or wrong or whether it's any of his business. Your father is still alive, and I was wondering if you were concerned that he'd see the movie and be offended, and if you can let that interfere with your writing.
If I thought he would be offended by anything, that would definitely interfere with my writing. There's a lot I didn't put in the movie about both my parents, but my dad has seen all of his scenes in the movie, and he loves it. And he's like, you know, it's the cloth that I'm cut from. He's also an oversharer and someone who's very open about being a human being and the mistakes he's made, and he knows it's an accurate portrayal. And he's thrilled, honestly. But yeah, I'm not like the art comes first. If I thought anybody that would be hurt by something, I would never write about it.
Did you have to make the decisions that your character makes when he moves into assisted living, of what to save and what to discard from his home, and to have to make those decisions without him?
No. No, the way that he went into assisted living was that he was he remarried, and he moved in with this woman who he was living with her in New Orleans. And then she out of nowhere kind of kicked him out and kind of left him on the side of the road in his wheelchair. And we had to just go get him and move him into assisted living. So she kept all of his stuff.
Wow, really?
Yep.
Well, that sounds...
And her name...
How old were you when that happened? Was this something
this
recent?
Might have been 4 or 5 years ago.
Well, so it's pretty recent.
Maybe more. My sister's saying more. Maybe six years ago. Yeah, it was horrible. I got the call, and I had to go on stage right after. And and it was traumatizing.
So here's what I'd like to do. I want to spend a few minutes talking with Amy about Inside Amy Schumer. So,
are you asking me to leave, Terry?
I think for this part, I'd like to be alone in the studio with Amy. Is that okay with you?
That is fantastic. And Terry, can I say this for the show? I would just like to make very clear that I'm the first guest since probably William Buckley to be on the show twice in 3 weeks.
Wow.
And I thank you. I was here for the books.
That's right. That's right.
And then for Trainwreck, and I feel like I'm an important person, and l'chaim, as my people say.
Yes, congratulations, Judd. Is that why you brought balloons?
Yeah,
I thought
I'm
it was
pretty
weird.
Excited.
You brought your own balloons.
I'm pretty excited. There's a pretty big NPR party for me afterwards.
Wow,
it's like the Saturday Night Live Five Timers Club. It's the twice in 3 weeksers club.
It's just like a lot of like pale white people. Like holding up pens.
Well, it's been a pleasure to have you on twice in 3 weeks. So,
see you, Terry.
Congratulations on the film. Judd Apatow, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
I want to talk with you about one of the most original editions that you did on your show. And this has become like already like a classic edition of Inside Amy Schumer. It was a parody of the 1957 courtroom drama 12 Angry Men. In this one, the jury is debating whether Amy Schumer is hot enough to have her own TV show. And I just want to play an excerpt of this. And some of the great actors in this sketch are Paul Giamatti, John Hawkes, Vincent Kartheiser. And the foreman of the jury is played by Jeff Goldblum. And he speaks first as he's addressing the jury in this scene.
All right, gentlemen, we should probably remind ourselves at this point that today's vote decides if Amy Schumer is hot enough to be on the television. If we decide that she is not, then she's going to lose her television show or be put to immediate death, or both. I zoned out during that part.
Look, I'm just saying I'm undecided is all. I'm open to the idea, but I want to be convinced. So maybe you all who seem so certain could try to convince me.
Oh, I don't know. When I was her age, girls felt lucky if you just winked at them and let them make your tuna melt.
Hear, hear.
Now they all think they deserve TV shows. You got Mindy Nightmare and the Lena Girl Holocaust Hour.
Let me ask you a question. Where's Megan Fox's talk show?
I'd see a Kate Upton sitcom.
Okay, but are those girls funny?
Well, no women are funny. But, you know, if you have to hear them blab, they better at least be hot.
Thank you. But they're not going to get shows. You know why? There's no room left. All the slots have been taken by these manatees. Now this Amy Schumer's gonna be in a movie? I mean, we gotta stop this.
A movie?
That's too much. She's starring in it?
I definitely don't think she's protagonist hot.
But Kevin James is.
I don't need to think about him. That's why they hire hot chicks to stand around him while he's talking.
I thoroughly enjoyed Here Comes the Boom.
Maybe she doesn't have to not be on TV at all. You know, maybe she could play somebody like a wacky neighbor or a divorced obese woman with a funny dog.
Look, the point is, the more she's out there flaunting that chipmunk face, the more her type becomes acceptable.
Yeah, people get confused. It could throw the standard off for shows everywhere.
Yeah, they'll be thinking that quirky-looking dump trucks are okay to broadcast all over the dial. We can't let her do that.
Less Melissa McCarthy and more Jenny McCarthy.
Yeah, she's the funny one.
Remember when she convinced us not to vaccinate our kids against easily preventable diseases? That was hilarious.
It's a sketch from Inside Amy Schumer. How did you come up with the premise for this?
This was the first scene that I thought of in our over our hiatus. I thought about my two friends were male comics. They were deliberating at a party if they thought Michelle Williams was hot, the actress, and they're both, you know, really like kind of debating this and. They're like, I don't think I'd have sex with her. And I'm just like looking at them like, and they look like complete gargoyles, you know. And I'm like, and I just kept thinking of the word deliberating. And I was like, well, what's the ultimate deliberation? And, you know, there's a constant stream of articles and comments about Lena and Mindy and myself. And
how did you come up with the insults that you wrote the actors to say about
you? I wrote that one by myself. I got some help in the writer's room punching it up, and Jesse took a pass, but it was – that one was my baby because I've known now for – this is the third year I've done the show, so I know what it's like when you're like, oh, and you guys, like, everybody write a couple insults about me. Then you're handed all these new insecurities. Like, oh, right. I didn't realize, like, my ears were small. So I was like, I'm going to write this thing. So I wrote it. It was the hardest I've ever worked, and it was really difficult to cook up. At first, I think the first draft was like over 40 pages, just insults about myself, funny and original insults about myself. And I got kind of upset. Like, you know, it just got to me. I'd been writing. I was on the road, and I'm on trains and on planes, and I'm writing horrible things about myself, saying I'm built like a linebacker and have Cabbage Patch-like features And then I don't know, something just – and I wrote to Jesse Klein and Dan Powell, the other EPs on the show, and I was like, should I keep doing this? It's starting to feel kind of bad. And Jess was like, you want me to take it off your hands for a pass? I was like, yeah. And, you know, I spent so much time writing that and then writing which shots I wanted to recreate and preparing to direct it. I directed it along with Ryan McFall, our director, and the network said, sure. We kind of lied and made it sound like I was going to be a little more present in the episode than I was. And, And I'm so proud of it.
It's so great.
I can't believe it happened.
Do you feel that people have actually sat around debating whether you're hot enough to have your own TV show or hot enough at least for basic cable?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I don't think people are spending all their time thinking about me, but I do think that I've just – enough feedback has reached me where people are like, I can't decide if you're hot or not. Like, they're plagued by it. They're like, it's actually
– is that funny?
You know, they kind of look on the internet to see how – if they're attracted to me or not.
I think that women of different generations love you, and I'll put myself in this category, and – It's in part because you're so good at taking down stereotypical images of women and social expectations projected onto women, and you do it with such hilarious satire, and it's like you're really making okay for the rest for women to be themselves and not feel like they're second rate because they're not. Fulfilling
That's
these artificial
fully
expectations,
tear up.
You know.
Fully tearing up over here, Terry.
Yeah, so.
Didn't see that happening for me today. That means a lot to me.
Oh, so before you tear up, let me point out the downside of this.
Okay, good.
Ready? That so many women, because you've become such a hero, that everybody now wants you to validate their choices, for your humor to validate their choices. So if you say anything that doesn't validate the choices I've made in my life, then I'm going to feel like you let me down because you're
like,
doing this.
Like, what's an example? I kind of know what you mean, but I just want to make sure I understand.
Oh, well, like, say you decide not to have children, or say you decide to have children, then
right.
I could say, like, hey, she copped out. She was making this alternate choice of not having children, and now she's had a child, so, you know,
right.
I'm signing off. Like, you can't represent, like, everybody's needs and everybody's choices that they've made in life.
I remember I love Ani DiFranco, and I've been a fan of hers since I was, I don't know, 12, and was like going to see her do shows at Roseland at that age. And I remember, you know, she was this just, you know, beautiful singer, but also like these angsty, I'm not going to take any crap from anybody. And then she kind of softened about some things, and she had a baby and she fell in love. And I remember her just expressing that some people felt kind of let down by that and how unfair that seemed. And I remember thinking that was really unfair. So I just know that I'm not going to try to be that for everybody, and that I like truly am someone who has no judgments about the way people are. Like, if someone doesn't like enjoy having sex or anything and they want to live completely the opposite of me, I have no judgments about that. And so I think when other people have expressed that, I feel no connection. I feel no connection to it. I don't feel bad about letting someone down.
Amy Schumer wrote and stars in the new movie comedy Trainwreck. On Thursday, she was nominated for an Emmy for Best Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for her performance in her Comedy Central series, Inside Amy Schumer. Jason Isbell has a new album, his first since his widely praised 2013 record, Southeastern. Since that time, Isbell has toured the country extensively with his band, the 400 Unit, and his wife, Amanda Shires, a violinist, singer, and songwriter. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the new album, Something More Than Free, finds Isbell exploring a wider range of subject matter and musical styles.
That song, The Life You Chose, typifies much of the music on Jason Isbell's new album, Something More Than Free. a medium-tempo composition with instrumentation that clears space for Isbell's voice and lyrics to be heard clearly, the song rewards close listening. Isbell sings about meeting up with a woman he used to be in love with, and now is mostly in love with the memory of what they had together. It's a song that's carefully packed with details, remembering what they used to drink and what book she was reading, admitting to living in nostalgia, even as he genuinely wonders about the life she leads, with the implication that he's not quite living the one he wanted. It's a beauty of a song in an album filled with beauties.
When I get home from work, I'll call up all my friends and we'll go bust up something beautiful. We'll have to build again. When I get home from work, I'll wrestle off my clothes and leave them right inside the front door, 'cause nobody's home to know. You see, a hammer finds a nail, and a freight train needs a raise, and I'm doing what I'm on this earth to do. And I don't think, oh, why I'm here where it hurts. I'm just lucky to have the work. Sunday morning, I'm too tired to go to church, but I thank God for the work.
Isbell's past as a member of the rock band The Drive-By Truckers now seems a lifetime ago. The new album comes across most often like some combination of folk music and the kind of country albums made in the 1970s by singer-songwriters like Roger Miller, Tom T. Hall, and the pre-outlaw Willie Nelson. There's an emphasis on the lyrics. Isbell is a compulsive storyteller, and yet he avoids elaborate wordplay or literary pretensions. Instead, he tucks in small phrases that do the work of long prose paragraphs, as when the narrator of To a Band That I Loved says, "I was 22 backwoods years old," a mini-sentence that compresses William Faulkner with the short stories of Dennis Johnson.
Though everyone tried to ignore us, we'd scared them all off by the chorus. And there you stood looking proud. What was left of the crowd at our show? And I was 22 backwards years old. You were singing that night by yourself, and I thought I was the only one left from an old southern town. New ideas bouncing around in my head, and I thought everyone like me was dead.
As a chunk of music with words, the song that leaps out of this album most eagerly is 24 Frames. The title refers to the speed at which celluloid film unspools through a projector. And, as if describing a film to someone who hasn't seen it, Isbell's verses offer impressionistic details about lives in distress and despair, even as the melody and the surging music of his band, the 400 Unit, make everything sound absolutely wonderful.
This is how you make yourself vanish into nothing, and this is how you make yourself worthy of the love that she gave to you back when you didn't own a beautiful thing. And this is how you make yourself call your mother, and this is how you make yourself closer to your brother. Remember him back when he was small enough to help you sing. You thought God was an architect, now you know he's something like a pipe bomb ready to blow. And everything you built, it's all for show, goes up in flames in 24 frames.
Where his previous album contained a lot of contemplation about the serious trickiness of leading a sober life, Something More Than Free is a collection of songs about how the narrator is freed from the bondage of self so that he can be of better use to other people. The music may frequently be quiet, but it as often as not rings with the promise of joy.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Jason Isbell's new album, Something More Than Free. In a time when so many African-American parents are worried that their son will become the next Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown, our guest, Ta-Nehisi Coates, has written a book in the form of a letter to his teenage son. It's titled Between the World and Me, and it draws on history as well as personal experience to discuss the different forms of violence young African-Americans are especially vulnerable to from all directions, on the street, in school, and from the police. Coates was born in 1975 and grew up in West Baltimore, where he says everyone had lost a child somehow, to the streets, to jail, to drugs, to guns. Coates is national correspondent for Atlantic Magazine. Terry Gross interviewed him earlier this week.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, welcome back to Fresh Air. You wrote this new book in response to the recent police shootings of African-American people, children and adults. The book is addressed to your teenage son. So when you were growing up in West Baltimore, what did the police mean to you when you were your son's age?
They were another force. So there are two sides of this, you know, because I don't want to be too cynical here. I am an American, and so I did understand them as representing, you know, some aspect of the state that I was a part of, some aspect of the country that I was a part of. But at the same time, there was definitely another part of me that basically recognized them as another element within the society, within the community, with no real moral difference from the crews and the gangs and the, you know, packs of folks who dispensed violence throughout the neighborhood. The police were another force to be negotiated that could dispense violence.
Did you ever see the police as possibly protecting you from violent forces within your own neighborhood?
Yes, I did. But I also saw the crews the same way. You know, that's the interesting thing. I saw many, you know, of my friends who would be labeled as criminals in the same way. The question, you know, for me was, when do you call what? You know what I mean? So if somebody breaks into your house, you would call the police. Again, I don't want to, you know, be overly cynical here. You would call the police. But by the same token, if, you know, you happen to be walking somewhere and five people jumped on you and, you know, did some degree of violence, you probably would not call the police. You might call, you know, some of your cousins, or you might call some of your friends. So it really depended on what the case actually was.
You had a college friend. You went to Howard University, a man named Prince Carmen Jones, who was shot and killed by a policeman. The policeman said it was in self-defense after Jones tried to run him over in his Jeep. And you and everyone who knew Prince Jones didn't believe that story. You write about this in your book. Tell us a little bit about him.
I went to college with Prince Jones. It's very funny because when you write, it becomes sort of abstract for a while, and then when people ask you about it, suddenly it becomes real again. I went to college with Prince Jones. We weren't, you know, best friends or great friends, but he was someone who I knew, who I, you know, spent time around, who I had, you know, just a great deal of affection for. Prince was tall, probably about 6'4" or so, slender, beautiful, beautiful man, very, very handsome, extremely intelligent. He was from Texas. He went to a magnet school in Texas for math and science, statewide magnet school. As his mom explained to me, he was the only African-American student there. As I, you know, did the interviews for the book and talked to his mother, Mabel Jones, who lives in the Philadelphia area now, when I talked to her, what I realized was he was from a family, very, very well-to-do family, a mother who had grown up in dirt-poor poverty in Opelousas, Louisiana, whose folks were sharecroppers, who had, you know, basically worked her way out of poverty, had become a radiologist, had gone to LSU, had served in the Navy, you know, had basically done everything America tells you to do and had, you know, accumulated assets and some degree of wealth. And he was killed. He was killed. I mean, he's executed like an outlaw as far as I was concerned. The officers were attempting to track down someone who they had believed had stolen a gun from another officer. Somehow they got it in their head that the Jeep that Prince was driving either belonged to the guy who stole the gun or one of his friends. They ran the plates on the Jeep The Jeep came up with Prince's mother's address and Prince's mother's name in Philadelphia. They assumed that this, you know, could possibly mean that the Jeep was stolen, when in fact all it meant was that his mother had bought it for him. They followed Prince Jones out from the suburbs of Maryland, where they, you know, first began tracking him, into Washington, D.C., and then out into Virginia, where they shot him within, you know, mere feet of his fiancée's home. The thing about this that you know, when I ran it through my mind is this. The basic, you know, report from the officer was that Prince had attempted to back up his Jeep several times and ram the car that the officer was driving. So he had to kill him. He had to shoot him because his life was in danger. But I tried to imagine myself in Prince's shoes. The officer who was tracking him was not in a normal police cruiser. The officer was not in uniform. The officer, in fact, testified that he pulled out his gun, said police, but never showed Prince his badge. The officer was dressed in an undercover disguise like he was supposed to be a drug dealer. And, you know, this is how insidious it gets. I have to imagine myself followed from the suburbs of Maryland through D.C. out into Virginia, realizing at some point that I'm being followed, not having any idea that this is a cop, and then having somebody pull a gun out on me and knowing that I'm near my fiancé's house. So it always seemed to me perfectly logical, you know, that Prince perceived that he was under threat.
So given your personal experience with having a friend who was shot and killed by an undercover police officer who never presented his badge, never showed his identity, put that in context with the more media-covered recent shootings of African-Americans by police. What does that add up to in terms of the message you're trying to give your teenage son now about dealing with police?
I don't know that anything has changed in my mind, like in terms of like how I talk to him. There's a lot of reporting that, you know, depicts this as though there's a wave going on, you know, an uptick in events. But I doubt that there's actually an uptick. More people are paying attention, but I've been paying attention at least, you know, intently for the past 15 years.
Yeah, well, that's why I mentioned the media coverage, because I think that's what's changed, that there's cell phones, and the cell phones have led to media coverage. And people are like watching these incidents over and over and over again. And I think for people who haven't been directly exposed to that kind of, you know, police shooting brutality, it's very educational.
It is. And you know, the thing that I, you know, in my mind, and I don't know that we're at this point yet, and, you know, and this is why I say, you know, it really hasn't changed in terms of how I talk to my child, my son. There's a kind of evasion going on wherein people think about what the police did, and they say, well, this is a bad cop, or if we had body cameras, maybe we could do something about it. But there's very little critique about why our police operate the way they operate in the first place. Because that critique ultimately comes back to Americans themselves. We've spent the past, you know, roughly half a century or so growing increasingly draconian, stripping back, you know, people's rights in terms of how they deal with the criminal justice system, increasing the punitive nature of the criminal justice system once people are in the system's clutches. All of that is brought to bear when we think about each of these deaths. Behind each of these is something else, some sort of policy, some sort of decision. I you know, when Prince was killed, I actually did some reporting around his death in PG County, in Prince George's County, because there had been so many other cases like that. You know, and I'll never forget one of the folks telling me that Prince George's County, you know, at that time was one of the most wealthiest enclaves for African Americans in the country. And yet the police was one of the most brutal police departments in the country. How could that possibly be true? Well, you know, many of the citizens out in that county had made the same sort of calculations that white citizens around this country had made. Their great fear was crime, you know, and any sort of hint, any sort of, you know, inkling of crime, from their perspective, the police were empowered to do whatever they wanted. And so ultimately, for me, it's a question of where the citizenry is. You know, it's not just a question of what the police officers are doing. You know, it's a question of what policies, you know, we've decided to pass.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates. He has a new book called Between the World and Me that's addressed to his teenage son. And it's all about growing up, like his growing up and the lessons he learned from that growing up in West Baltimore. It's about growing up in a frequently violent neighborhood. It's about fear of people in the neighborhood, fear of the police. It's about things like the Confederate flag and the meaning of that. And Coates is a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. Last year, he wrote an award-winning cover story called The Case for Reparations. We've been talking about fear of the police and anger at the police. But you know, part of your book is how you lived in fear when you were your son's age, when you were a teenager, when you left the house because there was a lot of violence in the neighborhood. And you say basically everyone in your neighborhood seemed to be reacting out of fear. You were afraid of other kids. You were afraid of your father's beatings. You write, when I was about our age, each day fully one-third of my brain was concerned with who I was walking to school with, our precise number, the manner of our walk, the number of times I smiled, who or what I smiled at, who offered a pound and who did not. So I guess I'm interested in what were some of the behaviors you had to learn to protect yourself, just like walking to school, walking home from school, going to visit a friend.
Oh, God. Don't walk to school by yourself. Make sure you have at least five or six people with you. It's very interesting. When the Philadelphia 76, Allen Iverson, when he came into the league, there was all this critique because he went everywhere with a posse, and there was all this talk about posse. Why is Allen Iverson? And I immediately understood, you know, as a matter of physical safety for many years, you're trained not to go, you know, into places that you don't know by yourself. Getting back to those rules, don't go to certain neighborhoods unless you know somebody over there, unless, you know, your grandmother's there, unless you got a cousin there, unless you got a really, really close friend there. If you have a girlfriend in another neighborhood, you need to go with four or five or six other people. You guys need to be prepared and, you know, you need to, you know, be watching out. When you walk through the street, as my dad, I can hear my dad telling me this right now, walk like you have someplace to be. Keep aware, you know, keep your head on the swivel. Make sure you're looking, you know, at everything. Little things like understanding that I think about this all the time, that like the first really warm day of the spring or the summer when you're in school is actually a really, really dangerous day for you. Because there's going to be a lot of kids out and people are going to, you know, be feeling a certain way. And it's quite likely that, you know, some amount of violence might occur. And so you need to keep your eyes out on those particular days. Thinking a lot about which way you want to walk. You know, this is just particular to my middle school. I think about this all the time. You know, did you want to walk down the hill? Should you walk up the hill? Should you take a long, circuitous route, as I would sometimes, you know, through other neighborhoods with other friends from those neighborhoods so that you avoid certain people at certain times because they're, you know, already home by then? it's a laundry list. You know, I can remember having, you know, like lunchtime. You know, you might have a problem with somebody. Somebody might have a problem with you. So you say, well, I'm not going to lunch today. I'm going to, you know, spend my lunch period in the library, which is what I would do sometimes because you don't want to get caught with certain folks. And then it's the more insidious aspect of it, which is this. My disposition is not, you know, to the street at all. You know, it was not anybody who knew me, you know, growing up would tell you there was nothing street about me at all. But, you know, one of the first things I learned within my first year in middle school, because middle school is when you really start getting indoctrinated into this stuff, is that any sort of a physically, you know, violent threat made to you has to be responded to with force. You can't tolerate any, you know, anybody, you know, attempting to threaten or intimidate your body. You must respond with force. This had real repercussions. I mean, you know, like I go to school ninth grade year in my high school, you know, and I got suspended for threatening a teacher.
I was going to ask you about that because you refer to that in your new book, and yeah. I don't feel like I understand why that happened. Like, what did you say
or do that was so? I felt like he disrespected me.
By doing what?
He yelled at me in front of the class, like really, really loudly. And again, I mean, this was the sort of thing that you couldn't tolerate.
Is what teachers do sometimes.
I know. But see, it sounds like you're laughing because, like, it's funny if you've never been in the environment
where all you have is your dignity.
That's all you have. I mean, you know, teachers yell loudly at kids from time to time. You're exactly right. But if you live in an environment, you know, if you're, you know, from a place where all you have is, like, the basic, you know, sort of physical respect, you will talk to me in a respectful way. You don't have anything else to lean on. That's very serious. That's really, really, really serious, you know. if somebody yelled at me now, it probably would, you know, I'd, you know, sort of walk away and laugh. Well, I've accumulated certain things. I have certain things. I have a family. You know, I feel, you know, great personal value in myself and in my work and in what I do. I feel, you know, deeply loved by everyone around me. I don't feel like I live in a particularly violent environment. I wouldn't perceive being yelled at, you know, as necessarily communicating to other people around me that they too could disrespect me at any moment.
So you threaten the teacher and then you're arrested. Like what? Mm-hmm. How did that? What did you say?
I said something to the fact that, you know, if you say something like that to me again, I'm gonna knock you out. It was something, but it was a physical threat.
Wow. Okay.
And in that moment, I was not like it was not idle either. I was very angry. Uh-huh. I was really angry.
So who called the police? The teacher or the principal?
He did. We had school police.
Oh, school police. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. He called the police. The teacher called the police. Police came. And I probably, as I recall it, I got into some sort of verbal thing with the police, too. The police handcuffed me and took me downstairs. They called my parents. They wrote up an arrest report and everything. Eventually, they unhandcuffed me and released me and sent me home by myself to my parents. I hate saying this. Or maybe this is just what happened, okay? And I wrote the book. And I've written a book about this before. It's out there. It's the public record. They released me. I went home. My dad kicked my butt. And that was the moment, you know, where, like, and I've said this several times, where he says to my mom, and I see this clearly, you know, my mom was really, you know, upset and had never really been upset about, you know, my dad dealing out physical discipline. My mom would deal out physical discipline. My mom beat kids. I mean, but it really upset my mom, the sight of it. You know, I was 14. I, you know, was, you know, becoming a big kid by then. And she tried to stop him. And he said to her, you know, either I can do it or the police. And so I go through this thing in the book about fear and what I understand now, and this don't make it okay. And this doesn't mean that it's what I would do, but what I understand now is how deeply afraid my parents were when they heard I got arrested. I remember my mom later, you know, after all this, you know, blew up, maybe like a couple hours later that same day, talking to me about it and just like crying, like just breaking down and crying. And they're African-American families, you know, around this country, a large, large number of African, that just operate out of complete fear that their kids are going to be taken from them and will do anything, you know, to prevent that.
What did you have to learn about loving your son as a father that was different from how you were loved?
I had to learn not to be so hard. I had to learn to not be so hard. And I had a wife, and at that time a partner when Samari was born, and for most of Samari's life a partner, who for whatever reason did not have to learn that and was very tender and very, very soft with him. When I saw that, for whatever reason, I didn't process that as, oh, that's his mother, she's being that way. Like, I immediately wondered why I wasn't that way. You know, and I labored, I very, very much labored to be that way, you know, to be softer, to be, you know, affectionate, you know, to tell him, you know, little things, to tell him I love you every night and to kiss him every night before he went to bed. You know, my parents love me. It's just not something that we did. It wasn't manifested in that way. I learned it from my spouse. I learned it from my wife. And now, as you know, we enter into this period, you know, he's going on to 15 and I can see the end, and I'm sad. Like, you know, I'm learning that this is not going to be forever, that he's going to leave me one day. I'm very happy I did that, you know, because if anything ever happens to me, or God forbid anything ever happens to him, it cannot be said that I did not make it clear to him every day how much I loved him.
Ta-Nehisi Coates is the author of the new book, Between the World and Me. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.